Iran condemns the conviction of an Iranian diplomat in Belgium on false terror-related charges, calling for his immediate release. The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah says that the enemies have failed to turn the people against the resistance group and cannot achieve their goals through economic pressure. And the European Union condemns Israel's plans to evict some 1,200 Palestinians from 8 villages in the occupied West Bank to make way for a military training zone. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in for World News. Iran has called on Belgium and 2 other European countries to respond to objections concerning the conviction of an Iranian diplomat over an alleged bombing plot which Tehran has deemed unlawful. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Saeed Khatibzadeh said that Tehran will keep up legal efforts to help free Asadullah Asadi, a diplomat at Iran's embassy in Austria. He was detained in Germany and then sentenced to 20 years in prison in Belgium in 2018 after being accused of setting up a bomb attack against the anti-Iran terrorist group, the MKO. The spokesman said the entire case is a scenario acted out by the MKO to spread Iranophobia. He reiterated Iran's position that the detention, trial, and conviction of the diplomat were all violations of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. On Tuesday, a Belgian court dismissed appeals of 3 Iranians accused of participating in the plot. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says enemies have failed in their efforts to turn the Lebanese people against the resistance group. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah was addressing an election campaign rally in southern Beirut. He said massive turnout in Hezbollah's recent rallies sends a message to the enemies they cannot achieve their goals by exerting economic pressure on Lebanon. Nasrallah called it a duty of the Lebanese people to take part in the upcoming election. He also urged cooperation and coexistence among all political factions to make Lebanon a just and powerful state that could defend its territorial integrity and its sovereignty. Nasrallah noted that Hezbollah is capable of preventing Israel from exploiting resources in the East Mediterranean Sea claimed by Lebanon. The Hezbollah leader also stressed that resistance group will never allow any aggression against the country. He said resistance will always remain vigilant. The European Union has condemned Israeli plans to evict some 1,200 Palestinians from an area in the southern occupied West Bank to make way for a military training zone.
Settlement expansion, demolitions, and evictions are illegal under international law. The EU condemns such possible plans and urges Israel to cease demolitions and evictions in line with its obligations under international humanitarian and international human rights law.
The EU said the establishment of a firing zone cannot be considered an imperative military reason to transfer the population under occupation. The statement was in response to an Israeli Supreme Court ruling that approved forcibly expelling and demolishing the homes of Bedouin Palestinians from 8 villages in a region close to the city of Al-Khalil. The EU warned that evictions and demolitions only escalate an already tense environment. International calls, however, have failed to stop Israeli land grabs. In the latest such act, the regime razed a 3-story building in the occupied East Al-Quds, occupied by Palestinians, displacing more than 30 of them. The Israeli regime says the building lacked a permit, but such documents are almost impossible for the Palestinians to obtain. On May 10, 2021, Israel launched a war on Gaza, killing and injuring hundreds of civilians, including women and children. War came to an end 11 days later. That followed fierce resistance by Palestinian factions who launched thousands of rockets against the regime, forcing it to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shannon has your story.
A year ago, Israeli regime forces bombed hundreds of buildings in the Gaza Strip during the 11-day war, also known as the Sword of Al-Quds Battle. The wanton Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. The Gaza-based resistance groups Mili Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Resistance Committees also fired some 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin al-Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli attacks on Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Overwhelmed by the significantly developed military capabilities of Palestinian resistance factions, the Israeli regime was forced to announce a unilateral ceasefire.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinian resistance factions fired thousands of rockets against the Zionist regime, forcing it to desperately call for a ceasefire after 11 days. The resistance is prepared to respond to any aggression, and nowadays the military capabilities of the resistance are better than last year. The Zionist enemy must understand that attacking Al-Quds will result in a new war.
The 11-day war saw the heaviest fighting between Gaza resistance factions and Israeli regime forces since 2014. Over the past decade, Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza have been boosting their production capacity for homemade rockets and drones. During the May war, Israel's Iron Dome also proved to be a failure. The multi-million-dollar high-tech missile system was unable to protect the Israeli regime.
During the 11-day war last year, 2021, Hamas and the Palestinians scored very well against Israel in a number of things. One is the launching of rockets against Israel closed very much Israeli airports, ports, and the Israeli business community. In addition to that, the Palestinians succeeded in unifying all fronts.
The Israeli regime has waged four wars on the Gaza Strip since 2007 under the watchful eye of the international community.
Experts believe in any future war, the Israeli regime will be dealt a heavy blow by Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
An international donor conference in Brussels pledges over 6.4 billion euros to support Syrians. Aid agencies claim the money is not enough and express concern that Ukraine is overshadowing humanitarian crises taking place elsewhere around the world. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
Representatives from 55 countries and 22 international organizations gathered in Brussels on Tuesday to raise money for Syrians impacted by more than a decade of conflict.
The total pledge amounts to 6.4 billion euros.
Aid agencies say that amount pales into insignificance when compared to the colossal amount of money the West continues to pump into the Ukrainian army, not to mention the cost of taking in a huge number of Ukrainian refugees. Rights groups point out that 7 million Syrian refugees fled to neighbouring countries while the EU closed its borders to them during the past 11 years. Recently, within weeks, the EU welcomed 5 million Ukrainian refugees. For the first time, Russia was not invited to the annual fundraising conference for Syria in Brussels. Moscow was even singled out for blame.
The Russian war will increase food and energy prices, and the situation in Syria will become worse.
Critics say it was in fact the US and its EU allies that tore Syria apart and then turned their backs on the Syrian people. The West tried in vain for years to oust Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Russia should have been invited to the Brussels conference, it suggested. Analysts say Vladimir Putin's address delivered last Monday was moderate in tone.
So maybe this is the momentum which needs to be seized by the Americans, by the European Union, and say, okay, we have to figure this out. Let's see that we can talk.
Delegates heard how 90% of people in Syria are living in poverty. Groups like Oxfam and Save the Children say all the financial pledges made must be kept. That has not happened in previous years. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The deadlock between the UK and the European Union over post-Brexit trade arrangements in Northern Ireland is once again taking center stage, with both sides issuing stern warnings. The British Prime Minister says that the situation regarding the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol is now very serious. Boris Johnson added the UK government will take action to protect peace and stability in Northern Ireland if necessary. Now, British media also reported that the UK is set to ditch large parts of the protocol after giving up on talks with the bloc on the Brexit deal. On the other side, the German Chancellor has warned Britain against making any unilateral changes to the protocol.
We have found a good way forward for Northern Ireland, and no one should unilaterally scrap or break or in any way change the arrangement we agreed on together, especially because we know that this is a difficult and complicated question, which is not just about the European Union and the United Kingdom. It also impacts upon the prospect of peace in Ireland.
Scholz was speaking at a joint news conference with the Belgian Prime Minister, who echoed the German Chancellor's remarks. Alexander De Croo warned that revocation of the agreement will avoid the entire system. The Northern Ireland Protocol was part of the UK's divorce deal with the European Union. It effectively creates a customs border in the sea between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK to preserve the country's open land border with EU member Ireland. However, tensions are once again surfacing over the issue after this week's elections in Northern Ireland. Largest unionist party there is now threatening not to take part in the government unless the protocol is abandoned. The war between Russia and the Ukraine, is on its 76th day, but the U.S. says that the conflict may turn into a war of attrition.
The next month or two of fighting will be significant as the Russians attempt to reinvigorate their efforts, but even if they are successful, we are not confident that the fight in the Donbas will effectively end the war. We assess President Putin is preparing for a prolonged conflict in Ukraine, during which he still intends to achieve goals beyond the Donbas.
U.S. Director of National Intelligence says she sees no path forward for the peace talks between Moscow and Kiev, at least in the short term. The U.S. official also predicts the fighting could take unpredictable turns over the next few months. Meantime, Russia's defense ministry says it thwarted Ukrainian efforts to recapture the Snake Island located in the Black Sea. According to the ministry, the Russian army inflicted heavy casualties and damage on enemy forces in the area. Data from the UN shows war has so far displaced over 8 million Ukrainians internally. Now, this on top of nearly 6 million others who have already left the country. And Ukraine says it's going to suspend the use of a transit point for some Russian gas headed to Europe and switch the flow to a new point. Russia says the move is inessential and impossible. Kiev says it will redirect gas flow from the current point located in an area under the control of Russian forces to another one in a Ukraine-controlled area. Kiev blames Moscow for the move, but Russia's Gazprom says it's technically impossible to shift all the gas to a new transit point. The Russian company says it sees no proof of any obstacle which necessitates such a move. Gazprom says Ukraine is going to halt gas flows Wednesday morning. Ukraine is a major transit route for Russian gas to Europe. Meantime, Western countries are working to phase out Russian energy imports altogether. And China once again slams the U.S. For political manipulation, as it puts it, over Taiwan, reiterating its sovereignty over the self-ruled island.
There is only one China in the world. Taiwan is an inalienable part of China, and the government of the People's Republic of China is the only legitimate government. This is an overwhelming consensus of the international community and the widely recognized norm governing international relations.
Li Jian's remarks come in response to the U.S. State Department's stance on Taiwan. On its website, the State Department has removed the wording of both not supporting Taiwan's independence and acknowledging that Taiwan is part of China. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman called the move an attempt to change the status quo in the Taiwan Strait. He says such attempt will inevitably stir up a fire but will end up getting burned itself. China considers the island its territory and views the U.S. activities as a sign of support for Taiwan. U.S. President Joe Biden says he is discussing lifting trade tariffs on Chinese goods imposed by his predecessor, Donald Trump. Biden said, however, that no decision has been made on the matter yet. The Biden administration has come under fire for not doing enough to alleviate financial pain inflicted by Trump's trade war with China. He's under increasing domestic pressure to remove the tariffs on China to cut soaring inflation by making imports cheaper. This as the U.S. is seeing the impact of COVID-19 and the Ukraine conflict that have pushed the cost of living higher. Trump imposed heavy tariffs to punish China for allegedly unfair trade practices. Beijing then took tit-for-tat measures and slapped levies on billions of dollars worth of American products. Labor Party leader Sir Keir Starmer has pledged to step down if he is fined for potentially breaching COVID lockdown rules. Now, Starmer and several members of his senior team are being investigated by Durham police after reports emerged they had enjoyed a curry and drinks while assisting with a by-election campaign in the area. Labor officials have denied any breaches occurred, but now have to wait for the results of a probe.
Opposition leader Keir Starmer has been at the front of the chorus, urging Prime Minister Boris Johnson to do the decent thing and step down after being fined for his part in a series of lockdown gatherings dubbed Partygate. Now the Labour leader has become embroiled in a controversy of his own, nicknamed Currygate, after being pictured enjoying a meal and a drink in what the party's calling a work event, but one being dubbed an illegal gathering by his opponents.
First and foremost, no rules were broken. I don't actually believe that those that are accusing me believe rules were broken. They are trying to simply drag all politicians into a place where the public think we're all the same. For me, this is an in-principle position. No rules were broken. I'm absolutely clear about that. But in the event that I'm wrong about that and I get a fixed penalty notice, I'll do the right thing and step down.
Political observers think this is a risky strategy.
Well, I think that his advisers think this is a really good ploy to contrast him with Boris Johnson, who, of course, didn't resign, having been fined for breaking the lockdown regulations. But it's a dangerous ploy as well, because he's not in control of what the police investigation is going to find. And if he does get fined, he's now been committed to resigning as leadership of the Labour Party.
The Labour Party had desperately wanted to take the moral high ground when it came to their handling of COVID rules and regulations, not just in the House of Commons, but in the court of public opinion. But now with their leader caught in the spotlight because of his own missteps, supporters of Boris Johnson are hoping to capitalize on this political mistake and make Labour pay.
Whether or not the leader of the Labour Party is fined, for many of the electorate, this is yet another letdown. Politicians who seemingly are unwilling or unable to play by the rules. The police investigation could take as long as a month to conclude. Now Labour and its leader must play the waiting game and cross their political fingers that this high-stake gamble has paid off. Mina Taylor, London.
Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را
شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's recommendations on political groups, especially MKO terrorist organization, and said that he had advised all terrorist groups to return back to the ocean of the Iranian nation and stop acts of terror to satisfy their masters in the West or the East. In this episode, we are going to touch upon his stance on leftist and separatist groups. Stay tuned, please. Concurrent with the victory of the Russian Revolution of 1917 and coming to power of a communist ideology in the country, leftist thoughts grew in many countries, particularly in the neighbors of Soviet Union, including Iran. Though the religious fabric of Iran and the sensitivity of the ruling system never led them to spread much among masses. Tudeh Party was the most important organized group among the leftist groups which came to existence in Iran after the Second World War. This party was eradicated in two phases. First, after the assassination attempt against the Shah in Tehran University, and then in the post-1953 coup period. Thus, its leaders and advocates escaped or were tortured or executed. A few of them also turned into spies of the regime through the pressures and temptations of the Shah agents. In 1960s, due to the increase of partisan struggles inspired by the thoughts of Che Guevara, Mao and Castro, and closure of political climate in Iran, some youth and students started armed struggles against the Shah. They intended to spread armed and partisan struggles to the whole society, a la China and Cuba, to topple the regime. But the Shah regime was fully supported by the US. As a result, the members of such groups would soon be identified and repressed before taking any serious measure. These groups were totally destroyed in late 1960s and early 1970s. At that time, the regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was in its most powerful days, thanks to the exorbitant oil revenues and relying on security and military support of the US and allies. In such circumstances, Imam Khomeini started his struggle against the Shah and the US with trust in God and relying on people's all-out support. Millions of men and women from all walks of life answered positively to Imam Khomeini's call to show their opposition to the regime of Shah. Therefore, they poured to the streets and chanted anti-regime slogans. The Imam's all-encompassing umbrella had indeed covered all political parties and every social stratum. Thus, the Islamic Revolution triumphed in a few months to the bewilderment of all analysts. Without doubt, the key element in this victory was the unmatched personality of Imam Khomeini and his charismatic leadership. The course of the revolution left no choice for political parties but to join the masses, even if they didn't believe in the ideology and ideals of the Imam and the people. This was the means for most of them to survive. The leftist groups had no belief in Islam, but had to join the people to survive. However, after the victory, they started to act as opposition and counter-revolutionary elements. They left no stone unturned to hurt the Islamic revolution. Imam Khomeini time and again advised them to return to the Islamic revolution and the Iranian nation. But they insisted on their stubborn thoughts and were finally exterminated. The Imam writes in his testament, "My recommendation to the leftists, like communists and Fadayi Khalq partisans and other groups with leftist tendencies, is that without proper studying of ideologies and the ideology of Islam, with those who are well aware of ideologies, especially Islam, which motive has satisfied you to be inclined to the ideology that has failed in the world today, and what has happened that you have become content with few isms whose content is null with researches? What has motivated you to intend to draw your country to the lap of the Soviet or China and to fight your nation in the name of love of two-day party or hatch plots to the benefit of foreigners against your country and oppressed masses?" Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing leftist groups, writes in his testament, "You can see that since the onset of communism, its masqueraders have been the most dictatorial, the most power-seeking, and the most monopolist governments in the world. What nations were smashed and annihilated under the rule of the Soviet, claiming to support masses? The Russian nation, Muslims and non-Muslims, have been struggling with twitches under the pressure of the Communist Party and are denied any freedom and are living in suffocation worse than that of the world dictators. Stalin, who was one of the so-called bright figures of the party, we were witness to his coming and going and his protocols and aristocracy. Now that you, the Beagle, are sacrificing your life for that regime, the oppressed people of the Soviet and its satellites like Afghanistan are dying of their oppressions." Imam Khomeini continues to advise the leftist, "You who are claiming the advocacy of people, what crimes you have committed against these people wherever you could, as with the noble people of Amul, who you wrongly called your strong advocates and sent many of them deceptively to fight people and the government to be killed. You want to offer the Iranian oppressed and deprived nation to the Soviet dictatorship, and you are doing this treason under the guise of Fadayi Khalq and advocates of the deprived. The Tudeh party and its cohorts are doing this through conspiracy under the mask of supporting the Islamic Republic, while other groups are doing it through arms, terror, and blasts." Imam Khomeini writes in continuation, "I write as testament to you parties and groups, either those who are known as leftists or those who are feeding from and inspired by the West, or even those such as Democratic or Comolé parties who take arms in the name of autonomy and advocacy of Kurds and Baluch and have destroyed the deprived people of Kurdistan and other places and prevent cultural hygiene and economic services and reconstruction by the government on those provinces to join the nation. Now that they have experienced that they have done nothing and cannot do anything but making the inhabitants miserable, so it is to their benefit and that of the nations and regions to assist the government and give up rebellion, serving the foreigners and betrayal of their country. They should embark on building the country and be sure that Islam is better for them than both the criminal Western Pole and the dictatorial Eastern Pole, and it will fulfill the humane wishes of people better.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program, Islamic Upbringing. In this program, you will discuss issues, relevant questions, and other fields regarding the Islamic upbringing of children. And we would like to stress that the answers that we provide in this program are all based upon the narrations of the household of the Prophet, and of course of the Prophet himself, and upon the Holy Quran, supplemented with scientific research. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Ali Himani, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for joining us.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's my pleasure to be here in your studio.
Last time, dear Sheikh, we spoke about how important it is that we watch what we wear in front of our children and in front of our siblings as well. We are very, apparently, and from a look at Islam, we are very detailed and minute about such manners, like even the appearance and the clothes and the makeup that you put on your face, even in front of your family, can have an effect and does have an effect. So building on this, what about then teenagers or children from opposite genders or even from the same gender sleeping in the same room? Could there also be some risk factor involved in this? What does Islam say about this, dear Sheikh?
It's a very good question that you brought up. You know, I know that in the Western culture, they start giving a separate room right from childhood, you know, right from the baby when it's 6 months old. You put them in a separate room and you try and train them to sleep separately away from parents, right? That's one part of it. But then some people do not realize the mistake here, that they start putting all the siblings together in one room and mix them up, the brothers and sisters and all that stuff. that's okay up till a certain age, probably 5, 6 or maximum
before
7.
Before they reach the state card, they start to differentiate.
Right. On the other hand, the girls, they reach puberty and maturity much faster and much earlier than the boys. So for them, 7 years is the max. You should not allow girls to sleep in the same room with the other boys after 7 years old. You should give them a separate room.
And that's not to mention we also have some parents who have their children sleep with them in bed with them.
And that's okay up to a certain age, you know, probably up to 2 years, especially because the child is still, you know, feeding from the mother, breastfeeding. That's okay up to 2 years. But then slowly, once you start weaning the child out, then you have to also train the child to start sleeping separately in a different room.
Right.
And then particularly the boys and girls, right, don't let them sleep in the same room. Not just that, I would rather say that don't give a separate room to your child, particularly when he's closing up on puberty. Don't say that, okay, here's your room. No, you say, this is where you sleep, but that's not your room. That's a common room. The door's going to be open. The father or the mother can walk in any time. It's not something proprietary that you'd say, this is my room, my privacy, my...
isn't privacy a fundamental human right?
Privacy of...
That's what they say, at least.
Oh, no. We can counter-argue all those things. Privacy that does not lead to haram, that's okay. But if you're talking about privacy that is going to lead to haram or that's going to lead them into doing inappropriate acts, then that privacy is not worthy of providing or giving.
On that note, let's go ahead and take a break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Now, just before we went on a break, we said that we should not provide them privacy that leads them to sins, to sinning. We should provide them with privacy that does not lead them to that.
Correct.
So this, in essence, not providing them a room for themselves is a preemptive measure, right?
Correct. See, look, giving them a room where they can go and study so that there's no disturbance for the studying, giving them a room where they can go and, you know, offer prayers, offer salat.
Even rest, perhaps.
Or rest.
Right.
Or, you know, take a break or sleep. That's okay. But don't give them a room where they have a sense of ownership and they tell the parents, you can't come in without my permission. Are you getting my point? Giving them a room to relax, sleep, study, that's okay. But giving them a room and calling it their room where the child can walk in, close the door and say, you have no permission to come into my room. This is where the problems start. This is where you're telling them that I'm giving you a secluded space where you can resort to at times where I don't have access to it. So now you're free. You can do anything you want. And now the parent doesn't know what the child is doing. What is he browsing?
Especially in our age with phone devices, laptops.
What is he browsing? What is he watching? Right. What is he listening? Who is he talking to? What is he
all
talking
of this corruption.
About? All corruption and all possible areas and grounds for sins. So we don't give them a separate room with ownership. We say, your room? No. We say, a room where you will sleep, a room where you will study, and I can be there. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I remember my parents when I was growing up. I didn't have a separate room until I was like 18, 19. And whenever I wanted perhaps to play on the PC or to have an activity, it was always in the living room. Like I was forced to do it in the living room.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. This is the most important part, particularly this age.
Yeah.
Particularly this age. Like I mentioned earlier, that they are focused upon themselves. They are going through physical changes and hormonal changes. And there are times when they want to explore about themselves, even physically, right? So when they're physically exploring themselves, some of the scholars, the psychologists, Islamic psychologists suggest that even going for taking a bath, right? Keep track of it. If your child is taking longer than normal,
right.
Yeah, then be worried, you know, follow up on him. Like, what's wrong? What's happening? I need
right.
to go to washroom, or I need to take a bath, come out quick. Follow up upon him and create that urgency that come out now. Don't take too much time.
Create a sense in them that they are being washed.
Washed, exactly.
Right.
And that way you can keep track and keep control, keep a tab
right.
on them. To avoid them indulging into sins.
And just a side note, because when we say hormonal changes, some people, they might not understand it. They think, okay, the teenager, he sat down one day and he decided to sin. That's not how it works.
No, it doesn't work that way.
That's not how it works. So you shouldn't blame your teenagers for having these thoughts and sometimes even falling into these sins.
Correct.
Because there's a shared responsibility.
Correct.
The parents, they have a huge responsibility.
Correct. So let me build upon what we've been discussing so far. We have a tradition, we have a hadith in place which says that shaitan is closer to those who are alone, those who are left alone, particularly in this age. Can you imagine the risk that we're running? A child who's going through hormonal changes.
And who's seen things in his environment.
Exactly.
He has been stimulated already.
All the time from
right.
all this, you know, teenage friends he has in the
yes.
school. And they're doing
and
makeup
how
and acting.
Much they care about their appearance.
Exactly.
Right.
And then he's going through the sexual desires. He's trying to control them.
And
then
he has, you give him privacy. You give him a closed room. You give him a phone.
And the access to internet. What
free
else?
Free internet.
What else do you want? This is absolutely like, you know, preparing the grounds for him to prepare himself
to
indulge.
It's like you're telling him indirectly to do your stuff.
You're telling him, you know, you're free to do whatever you want.
Let's go ahead and say,
I think you have to be really careful here.
Sorry for interrupting you. Let's just go ahead and take a quick break.
Ya muqiya al-khayrat. Ya muqiya al-khayrat.
Regarding the sixth verse of Surah At-Tahrim, the 66th surah of the Holy Quran, that is, O you who have faith, save yourselves and your families from a fire. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said, save your families from fire by enjoining them to do good and forbidding them from evil deeds.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Now, just before we went on a break, we were talking about how we should not allow our children, do not give them the opportunity to fall into temptation.
Correct.
In essence.
Correct.
Right.
And I heard one of the scholars suggesting this idea when you mentioned about the mobile phones and laptops. I heard one of the scholars suggesting this idea, and you yourself mentioned about your family, that make the screen large. Right. So if your son wants to browse internet, you say, okay, here's the smart TV.
Right.
Here's your keyboard. Right.
Come on.
Okay, browse internet. All
right.
And right. then he's going to be like, whoa, I want privacy. Why do you want privacy if you're going to browse safe
right.
content? Why do you
yes.
need privacy?
Why?
Right? So give him a larger screen. You tell him, you know, why 8 inches
right.
or 13 inches? Let me give you 65 inches.
Yeah,
right?
What's the problem? I love you so much, I give you more.
More. Right. So be right here in the main hall, the living room, here's your 65-inch
right.
TV, here's your keyboard,
yes,
free
right.
internet
and
connection.
And I care so much about you, I'm going to sit beside you and
exactly.
watch.
So browse as much as you want.
Right.
If you have any questions and
yeah.
doubts, I'm right next
right.
to you.
In essence, you're actually talking to Iblis. You're not talking to
exactly.
a child, because your child has been taken by his temptations.
And this is where, you know, again, Iblis is impacting his thoughts
right.
and you're countering Iblis
yes.
and his argument.
That's why, in essence, you're talking to him. You're not talking to your child.
So you're not right. restricting the grounds for guna for your child, but
right.
you're restricting access of Iblis
yes.
to your child. You're
and branching off of this subject, dear Sheikh, it is because some children or some parents, they say that we're very proud of our children because they read books, they are book readers, and that's much better than using their phone and television. Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
Because the books are the same thing, but just in text version.
Correct. But again, much better than actually watching the whole thing
right,
right in front of your
yes.
eyes. But again, there are good books, right? So the parents have to be careful and aware of the kind of
right.
books the kids are choosing
right.
to read.
The important thing is supervision.
Yeah.
Even if it's book, a telephone, a laptop, whatever it is,
everything,
supervision.
Yeah, supervision. Because, you know, for example, maths, physics, chemistry, there's little probability of, you know, the
falling
sexual
into
element.
Sin. You're not
going to
look
sensual.
At an equation and
yeah, feel,
yeah,
you know,
course.
Sexually motivated or something
right.
like that.
Unless there's something wrong with you, but yeah.
On the other hand, there are other subjects which can lead to those thoughts.
Yes.
That should be monitored.
Like, for example, we have a
English literature, you know.
Exactly. All of these drama shows we have,
correct,
or films and series,
correct,
about,
right,
love and love interests and romance.
Correct.
And
correct. So some places, yes, you can be all lenient and give freedom when it comes to certain subjects, but certain subjects, certain things. So the fundamental question was separate room. Do we give them separate room? Do we allow boys and girls to sleep in the same room? No, no, no. Do we give them separate room?
With yes
the
and
explanation,
no.
Exactly. With the right explanation that we've already discussed.
Yes.
And monitor their usage of their TV, laptop, mobile phones, textbooks, books that they read, so on and so forth.
And with that in mind, we will have to end today's program because we are out of time. I thank you for contributing to this discussion and also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback, or some comments, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. You can also find us on various social media websites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In New Mexico, the fastest warming and most water-stressed state in the continental U.S., where wildfires have recently devoured over 120,000 acres and remain uncontained, the oil and gas industry is coming out in force to deepen the region's dependence on fossil fuels. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Lena First Arai, journalist. This article is published under the heading, How the Oil and Gas Industry is Trying to Hold U.S. Public Schools Hostage. Here's more. The U.S. oil and gas industry wants to play a word and picture association game. Think of four images: a brightly colored backpack stuffed with pencils, a smiling teacher with a tablet tucked under her arm, a pair of glasses resting on a stack of pastel notebooks, and a gleaming school bus welcoming a young student on board. What do all of these have in common? An April 6 Facebook post by the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association, MNOGA, asks, adding, they are powered by oil and natural gas. In New Mexico, the fastest warming and most water-stressed state in the continental U.S., where wildfires have recently devoured over 120,000 acres and remain uncontained, the oil and gas industry is coming out in force to deepen the region's dependence on fossil fuels. Their latest tactic, to position oil and gas as a patron saint of education. Powerful interest groups have deployed a month-long campaign to depict schools and children's well-being as under-threatened government officials infringe upon fossil fuel production. In a video spot exemplary of this strategy, Ashley Neiman, a fourth grade teacher at Enchanted Hills Elementary School, tells viewers that the industry is what enables her to do her job. Without oil and gas, we would not have the resources to provide an exemplary education for our students, she says, adding, the partnership we have with the oil and gas industry makes me a better teacher. The video from September last year is part of a PR campaign by NMOGA called Safer and Stronger. It's one of many similar strategies The Guardian tracked across social media, television, and audio formats that employs a rhetorical strategy social scientists refer to as the fossil fuel savior frame. What NMOGA and the oil and gas industry are saying is that we hold New Mexico's public education system hostage to our profit-motivated interest, said Eric Shelker Goodrich, executive director of the Western Environmental Law Center, adding, there is an implied threat there. Last year, New Mexico brought in $1.1 billion from mineral leasing on federal lands, more than any other U.S. state. But the tides may be turning for the fossil fuel industry as officials grapple with the need to halve greenhouse gas emissions this decade. Before mid-April, the Biden administration had paused all new oil and gas leasing, and the number of drilling permits on public lands plummeted. In response, pro-industry groups are pushing out what some experts have called the sky is falling messaging that generates the impression that without oil and gas revenue, the state's education system is on chopping block. NMOGA did not respond for comment. Since February, NMOGA PGA has flooded its social media pages with school-related motifs, like buses and books, but also with images of empty, abandoned classrooms accompanied by reminders about how the state's schools rely on oil and gas production and federal land for more than $700 million in funding. Elected officials have parroted this framing. This is a matter of critical importance to all, but especially to New Mexico's school children who have suffered greatly during the pandemic. State Representative Yvette Harrell co-wrote in the Santa Fe, New Mexico in February. But tax, budget, and public education funding experts say linking the federal leasing pause to a grave immediate risk to public education is deceptive. Any slight reductions stemming from pauses or other so-called adverse actions would have zero immediate effect on school funding overall, much less whether students get the services they need to recover from the ill effects on their learning from the pandemic, said Charles Goodmaker, former government and media relations director at the National Education Association, NEA, now a consultant. The sale of leases does not lead to immediate drilling, he said. Often companies sit on leases for months or years before production occurs. Industry attempts to convince New Mexicans that the state's public education system is wholly dependent on oil and gas are based on a tough truth. Decades of steep tax cuts have indeed positioned fossil fuels as the thunder behind Democratic-led New Mexico's economy. In 2021, 15% of the state's general fund came from royalties, rents, and other fees that the Department of the Interior collects from mineral extraction on federal land. Oil and gas activity across federal, state, and private lands contributes around a third of the state's general fund of $7.2 billion, as well as a third of its education budget. Some on the receiving end of oil and gas revenue stress that not all educators and students embrace fossil fuel industry money in public schools. Mary Bissell is an algebra teacher at Cleveland High School in Rio Rancho, who co-signed a letter in November, along with more than 200 educators asking NMOGA to stop using New Mexico's teachers and kids as excuses for more than oil and gas development. Bissell says in spite of how cash-strapped schools may be, many of her colleagues don't want oil and gas money. I'm not going to teach any kids how to find the slop based on fracking, she said of her math courses. Bissell characterized NMOGA's attempt to portray educators as a unified force beholden to oil and gas funding as disgusting.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.